and welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Jose Moreno Carbonell is my latest guest, and it was wonderful to catch up with Jose. And I kind of feel our paths must have crossed once before. We were both at university in Lampeter around the mid-1990s. Jose comes from Spain. He lives in France. He's a high school Spanish teacher, and he's just had a novel published. It's a recreation of oral tradition from his home village, mixed with classical mythology and 20th century Spanish history. And he wrote it during lockdown. Jose talks about how the novel came about and how writing was a survival strategy. We learn about Jose's earliest memories growing up in Spain. He comes from a family of school teachers. He always wanted to be a writer. And we find out how he couldn't have been a writer if he hadn't become a teacher. And we learn about TV influences when he was growing up in Spain, when there was just one TV channel. We talk about the music our children listened to and how Jose started liking his father's classical music when a teenager. We talk about the musical accomplishments that our children inherit. We talk about teachers who made an impression and about Jose's time in Lampeter and the benefits from living there compared to city life. Jose tells me a story from the time when he was 12 involving a Nobel Prize winner for literature, The Three Musketeers, and false memories. We talk about what we want to remember from lockdown. We learn what Jose wanted to be as a teenager, and we learn that he wrote his first song last year. Then at the end of the interview, we talk about the advantage sometimes in not being paid for the things that we love doing, and why Jose is a looking forward kind of person, and why, as he puts it, this year's Christmas will be next year's nostalgia. It was an absolute privilege to catch up with Jose for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it's an absolute pleasure for this week's nostalgia interview to meet Jose. And Jose, we were just saying, of course, that many years ago, back in the 90s, our paths would have crossed in Lampeter.
Yes, yes. we must have, although we didn't meet properly, but we must have been at the same place at the same time at one moment or another.
Yeah. And I always think with things like diaries or, you know, there's a way I'd love to go back, like in Back to the Future with the DeLorean. I'd love to go back in time and, you know, sort of the people that you know now who we didn't know then in a different light, get to know each other and perhaps see if conversations would splinter off in all sorts of different directions. Do you want to say a little bit, Jose, about what you do and where you're based?
All right. I live in Reims in France. Although I come from South Spain, but I'm a high school teacher, and I also have I also teach a seminar in Sciences Po Paris, but it's only one seminar. And mainly my main job is high school teaching, and I teach Spanish literature and culture.
And very impressively, you've just had a novel published, is that right?
Yes, at last. Yes. After many, many years, I just finished publishing it. It's a great moment for me because I've been waiting for a very, very long time to do such a thing.
Oh, I'm so pleased because that's obviously something I'd love to talk to you about because just the enthusiasm in your answer there, because it's obvious that this is something that, as I find with maybe not teaching at the same, you know, the same subject or the same, you know, level, but a job can sometimes both inspire but also suppress that creative urge and talent, because, you know, by the sound of it, you've wanted to write this novel for a long time and you finally got to do it, and that must be such an amazing experience.
Yeah, it is.
Do you want to say a little bit about what the novel is about?
Well, the novel is a recreation of oral tradition from my home village. And it's mixed up with classical mythology, Roman mythology, Roman and Greek mythology, and with some of the events of the Spanish history in the 20th century that I have mixed it up in a polyphonic novel.
But by the sound of it, that's something that you've been either working on for a long time, or suddenly it just sort of, you know, came out of your, you know, creative imagination. I mean, is this something that you'd always wanted to work on? Is this the sort of like the summation of many years of research? And, you know, were there any other attempts along the way to write what resembles this finished monograph?
Well, yes and no. Actually, it's the novel itself. It was written during the lockdown. But the ideas, many of the ideas come from, many of the characters come from three plays I have already written. It's a kind of personal universe I have recreated of my home village. And that was very, very long. But the longest was to write the first place, the first play. I wrote the first line of the play when I was 18, and I think that I finished it 15 years afterwards. So, but the novel itself, it started with a short story, and has happened to do exactly with the place. It's just a friend of mine who is a Greek teacher in the university. She asked me if I would like to write a recreation of Ulysses myth, and that was the beginning. That was the first mythological story I wrote about my village. And then during the lockdown, because I was working on other projects, but because I just needed to write, so I couldn't do research or. So I needed to write about something that I really knew very well. And well, obviously I did some research because of the classic literature I was brushing up on from my high school years and university years. I actually wrote it quite quickly. It was not exactly during the lockdown, but after the lockdown, because during the lockdown with the online classes, we have a lot of work to do, but during the summer of the 2020.
And do you think if it hadn't been for lockdown, do you think that you'd still be sitting on it and, you know, wanting to write this, but not having the chance to do so? Do you kind of feel that it was almost like inevitable that you were going to write this around the time that you did, and lockdown sort of just gave you the opportunity or the space even to finally put, well, not necessarily pen to paper, but, you know, I assume that you typed it out, but was it very much the case that circumstances just sort of aligned in a very felicitous way in what, 2020, 2021?
Well, it was actually because of the lockdown. Otherwise, I wouldn't have wrote it. And I wouldn't have published it.
Yeah.
Because I was working on other projects and much longer.
Yeah.
And I needed sometimes the pandemic has said that we always think that we can do it later. And then at the time we thought no, we have to do it now because otherwise maybe we won't be able to do it.
My sense, absolutely, yeah. Lockdown, in a funny way, I mean, I always joke to people that I'm never going to be nostalgic about lockdown, but at the same time, lockdown did enable people to think outside of the box, while also, of course, having to in some cases work harder because you had to regroup and retrain and reskill, you know, using digital technologies in order to do the things that otherwise we'd be doing in a physical communal space.
Yeah, and on the other hand, for me, writing was a kind of survival strategy that I needed to do it to feel good, because it's the thing that makes me feel better. It's to write, definitely.
Yeah, it's funny. I think almost lockdown for so many people was like pressing that reset button. It was like we didn't choose to be locked down. We don't want to be locked down. It's changed our life, but we're not going to let that determine us. So in a funny way, the lockdown ensured that at least in terms of our creative muses, something was unleashed. So, you know, physically we were constrained, but we were able to do things that when yes. we weren't constrained in that way, we weren't able to do. So it was just like a liminal, you know, turning around an upending, a subversion of the usual dynamics.
Yeah, definitely, because human being is flexible, is resilient. So I think that if you press on from one side, and then your survival strategies take place. And obviously, for some people, it's really much more difficult, because I was not in a difficult situation. I was living in a house with a garden, with my two kids and my wife, and I was able to do the job I was wanted to do. So
no, that's terrific, and I hope it goes from strength to strength, and you know, whether there are any other novels in the pipeline, but certainly I hope this one is, obviously I know you've written it in Spanish, but you know, I hope that it gets the circulation and the recognition which just sounds so awesome. So huge congratulations to you. Do you want to just say a little bit, Jose, about your background? You mentioned that you were born in Spain and that you live in France, and obviously at one period we our paths crossed, whether we knew it or not, in Lampeter in West Wales. So do you want to say a little bit about maybe, for example, your earliest memories and you know, a bit more about life growing up in Spain?
All right, yeah. My earliest memories were, I was born in a city by the sea, what is called Almería. It's not very, very famous, although some things could be recognized, as it was during the 70s, it was the capital of spaghetti western, because it was much cheaper for the Italian to film films in Spain than in the United States. So many films have been shot in Almeria, in the desert. But my family are coming from a small village in the mountains, 80 kilometers from the sea, and we lived there until I was four. And my first memories are from my life during in my house in the village. Yeah. Then we moved off to Almeria. I stayed there my parents still have the house, and they go there every holiday.
So there's a huge family tradition there.
Very, very huge. And most of my family comes from the village, so both sides. So they go there on holiday every single holiday. And my sister still go there every holiday.
Yeah. And what did your parents do?
Well, my parents were school teachers, as my grandparents were two school teachers. Not the four of them, but my father, my dad's mom, my mother's dad were two school teachers at the village.
Does it feel like a sense of inevitability for you that you've ended up in the same profession, or was there ever a period when you thought, I'm absolutely not going to do this, or you know, or was it what you always wanted to do?
No, I was not. I was not supposed to do it. I mean, I was. I was brought up in the idea of not being a teacher, yeah. And it was quite accidental, mainly because I wanted to be a writer. And then if you want to be a writer, you have 99% chances of becoming a teacher.
Yeah.
It's like a musician, you a lot of chances to becoming a music teacher. Yeah.
You see, I always think of the film Tootsie, the American film Tootsie from the early 80s, where the idea is that all these wannabe actors, struggling actors, of course, actually work in bars and restaurants and cafes because as waiters, because for obvious reasons, you know, they're not going to get the paycheck from following their dreams as an actor.
Yeah, but actually, if one of the reasons I was always wanted to be a writer, but I think if I hadn't been a teacher, I would have never become a writer. still, if it's a gamma writer, I wouldn't be able to write if I had haven't had a job like a teacher. Because when I was younger, I was young. I was not mind structure enough, and it's the thing that you have to prepare some lessons, and you have to be organized, and you have to organize your idea to teach them. That's give me the self discipline to plan a writing, or and then I think as I start writing 4 or 5 years after becoming a teacher. Before that, I have written a little bit of poetry, but I was not able to write long stories or constructed stories. And I think that it's because of teaching that I have been able to have the maturity to do all such things.
Because I think there is that notion of counterpoint, really, where you've got like two different things going on in your life, but in reality far more than that, but you can play one off against the other. So if and we were saying that about lockdown a moment ago, so what should have been really terrible for us all and stopped us from doing the things we wanted to do actually allowed people to say, okay, let me think outside of the box. And I think being the teacher, because when you're teaching you're not writing, and when you're writing you're not teaching, but somehow you can ensure that you carve out the space so that the one sort of gives you the chance to do the other. And in a funny way, it may have made you both a better, you know, a better teacher and a better writer, because you compartmentalize and you put all your, you know, efforts into being a teacher when you have to teach and writing when you have to write. And if you've got those precious moments in the day, you can sort of fill the time appropriately.
Well, actually, I do both, because I write quite a lot for my students. And it's quite funny, because when I write for my students, I make it easy for them. So when I wrote the novel, it was like a kind of, well, now I can write as I want to do, because all the time I have, well, I do simple phrases and very repetitive phrases, something a writer should never do, like repeating the same word or not using synonyms. Like, do it on purpose, because if they see the word 5 times, then they're going to remember it easier than if they see it 1 time. So it's quite interesting. The exercise is quite interesting.
Yeah. And do you, in that sense, find that your time at Lampeter, where, well, you can tell me in a minute what you actually were doing at Lampeter, because I'm guessing that was in a postgraduate capacity, is that right? That perhaps framed you and sort of set you up for what you're doing now?
Not really. It was an undergraduate. It was an Erasmus program. I was taking a degree in English language and English literature in Granada University, and I was spent 1 year in Lampeter studying English literature.
Oh, fantastic. And in doing that, I mean, do you sort of look back on those days, looking back to the mid-90s or so, and do you sort of find that teaching is something that you may at the time have been very keen not to do, of course? You were saying, I definitely don't want to be a teacher, but do you sort of find that some of the things that you were doing when you were a student at Lampeter, an Erasmus student, has that kind of been something that has stuck with you in the years since in your teaching career?
Well, that's one thing, I didn't want to stay in Spain. I wanted to, I actually wanted to become an Spanish teacher, because I wanted to travel and to live abroad. It was not supposed to be France. It was supposed to be Britain, or mainly, I think it would have been the United States. But because of Lampeter, I finished up in France. Yeah. Because that's where I met my wife and decided to come to France. Yeah. And to learn French. I spoke a word of French before.
Because I liked the idea as well. You were saying that you absolutely didn't want to be a teacher, or at least you, that was, you know, you were determined that you would do something different. But I know people as well, it's funny as well, people who's, for example, their father, or in some cases their mother, might be a vicar, and they're like, there's no way I'm going to do that at all. And then some years later, you see them and they say, yeah, I'm going to become ordained. And you're thinking, that's really interesting, because you told me that you were absolutely not going to do that. And I wonder to the extent that it might make you better at what you do, because you rather than just sleepwalk into something, you're actually thinking, you know, I don't think I want to do this because that's what somebody else is doing before me, so I want to, my own life. But actually, in denying something or walking away from it or perhaps even starting up a completely different career plan, you might ultimately say, well, I've considered those options and actually maybe this is after all what I want to do. So you enter then that profession all the more convinced that it's the right one for you, because you've literally, you know, done everything that you can to ensure that if there was another career course, you would have jumped at the chance to pursue it.
Well, actually, it was to be honest, it was actually my parents that didn't want me to become a teacher, because many times you say that you think that the grass is greener elsewhere. And well, I started doing some training courses in teaching. I find it quite funny. So obviously, I knew the drawbacks of the job of the profession, but well, I think it was at the end it was worth. Yeah. I don't regret at all.
Yeah, and just thinking as well about growing up and particular things that you remember or enjoyed doing in your younger days, what about things like, I'm just thinking of sort of, you know, cultural influences, whether it was music or film or the theatre, was there anything, or indeed books, of course, as somebody who writes, but is there anything particularly from childhood that has sort of followed you through to today, any particular influences from when you were young that particularly stand out?
Well, apart from books, I would say television. It was because in Spain you have the television is always on. So basically, when I was a kid, I watched any kind of program. We only have one channel, and I watch it all. It was one of the things that when I was 12 or 13, I think, when I started to speak about having different channels, everyone would say, "Oh my, how are you going to do?" Today, when I go to school and we speak with friends at break, we speak about what we watched yesterday. Yeah. But if we have four or five channels, everybody won't be watching the same thing. So what are we going to do? What are we going to talk about? And even the TV program magazine that you bought every week. So I said, oh, it's got to be enormous, because we were used to just only have one or two channels. And in Almeria, we have the second channel only in 1982 for the Football World Cup. Yeah. So it was quite, but it was very interesting because, for example, the cinema I watched when I was a kid, I watched a lot of classic films, because just this is what it was. Alfred Hitchcock and Frank Capra, a lot of classic movies, and that makes it like of cinematographic culture that we, most of the people of my generation have, because this is just the one thing you could watch.
Yeah. And also in that sense, you're right. It's a kind of, it's a lens that people from different cultures can relate to and experience. And I mean, I suppose it takes other forms. I mean, you know, Eurovision or whatever, but, you know, there's a way in which communities and peoples, both in person and virtually, are very much able to come together with a shared cause. And I think you're right about what you said about television, because, I mean, my children who are very young, don't watch live TV. You know, it's all YouTube, etc. But at the same time, because you can share things with other children, and because obviously you can watch things on repeat rather than just wait for that program on a Monday night at 7 o'clock or whatever. You know, when we were young, those programs were on once a week at a designated time. We'd all, you know, fit our evening around about that particular program. They still share it in the playground. So my, you know, my children seem to sort of know cultural things that they haven't come, that haven't come from me. But I'm thinking, how do you know these things? And you know, in a way, it's back to what you were saying about the resilience earlier, that somehow, you know, it's going to find a way. You know, when we were young, we didn't have technology as, you know, as multifarious as it is today. These days, if anything, it's too overwhelming. But at the end of the day, people will just find the strands that they like, capitalize on them, and find those common connections. And and I find myself weirdly estranged from my own children in that respect sometimes. Like, how do they know these things that I've got no interest in or no knowledge of? You know, my seven-year-olds know things that I couldn't possibly have known at that age, nor even perhaps even even at my age.
Yeah, that's definitely with the music. I think it was one of the people you interviewed, Anna Wilson Richardson, said that her students would listen to the music their parents had listened to, and we would never do that, obviously. Yeah. Obviously, and it's the case with my kids. They just listen to the music they like it, and they don't think if it was their generation or it was the generation before or whatever. It just my son listens to classical music or to soul music, 70s soul music, 30s jazz music. It's quite eclectic.
Mm. That's really impressive, actually, because when I was younger, it was always, even now, you know, I'm able to compartmentalize, and I know the difference between stuff that my parents grew up with, because I, you know, would listen and be aware of their vinyl collection, and the stuff that was my generation, which was also noticeably not theirs. In other words, the stuff I grew up listening to when I was very young was decidedly not something that interested them whatsoever. But I also did develop an interest in their music. So it was almost as though, you know, I was accumulating the previous generation's selection and, you know, range of music. But now I'm just like my own parents, because my children are very young, but I've got no interest in the stuff that's out today, and I've just turned into my parents. You know, when I was young, I was interested in all the latest charts and so on, and then and now like them, I've got you know limited interest, in fact zero interest, and I think that may be a universal thing as well, that we there are things that are part of our era and we grow up with them, and that never leaves us, but that doesn't mean to say that we're always accumulating new ideas and new sounds. There's a point where almost like saturation point has been reached.
Well, my experience is a bit different, because my father is a musician. He has a classical taste, and we listen at home. We listen quite a lot of classical music, and he also plays traditional instruments. So I was brought up with this culture of classical and traditional music, but I have a step brother. Well, actually he's a cousin, but we was brought up together, and he's quite older than me. He's 15 years older than me, and he was nearly like a second father, because he was younger. On the other hand, I was brought up with his taste, and it was mainly the Beatles. Yeah. And then when I was a teenager, I started being interested in classical music, the music of my father. Usually, just when you are a teenager, you go against your father. It was the opposite. I start liking classical music, but the Beatles were always there. The Beatles have always been part of the scenery of musical education, and they have never gone.
Yeah, and it's lovely when that happens, because I find that with my own parents sometimes, that if there's an old chart rundown on the radio of, you know, when they were teenagers, I always want to share it with them and imagine, you know, what it was like to be their age, really, and to imagine what it was like to have those experiences first time round, because the sort of excitement that I had maybe in the 80s when I was growing up, I was sort of imagining that my parents 20 or 25 years earlier probably went through the same kind of excitement about in those days. Yes, it before the Beatles, I think, perhaps in their case, but certainly Elvis or the Everly Brothers or Lonnie Donegan, and you know, this is stuff that even to this day, you know, kind of still resonates for them.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Spain was a bit different because we don't have this in the 50s and in the 60s, music was really, really cut off from main, apart from people living in Madrid or in the big cities. So they just have this traditional music, and Spanish popular music is not something I really like a lot. But mind you, my parents didn't either. So
yeah, no. And do you ever find, though, that you're still keen to listen to or rediscover maybe or have another attempt at listening to some of the music that maybe first time around when you were younger, you tended perhaps not to be all that keen on? In other words, do you sometimes find that maybe through people your own age or just because there are certain connections or you perhaps remember or reminisce about stuff that you were, you know, the sounds of the time when you were growing up, do you ever go back and listen to that music again?
Well, I wouldn't say that. It's something that happened to me. It was really, really, really strange. My father, he's a guitar player. He used to have this song that he used to play when I was a kid. And there are not many, 20 or 30, but they have really run out with them. Well, my father, he wanted me to be a musician, and didn't work. It was not not good at all. But my son Lucas is quite a good guitar player. And as he grew up, it was one moment, and I said, "Oh, hang on, this is not happening. My son is playing the songs that my father used to play when I was his age." And I was really, 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 really amazing. Yeah. It's something fantastic. It's just wonderful because it's like kind of from generation to generation. Without me, obviously.
Do you know, that happened to me this weekend because I've got twin boys who are 7. And one of them, literally just yesterday, was playing the piano and doing a far better job than I was able to do at, you know, double his age. And I neglected the piano decades ago. But what was really funny is that he was sort of playing by sight. And that's something that my grandmother and actually my uncle as well, my mum's brother, was able to do. And my mum didn't really play the piano. I was never that keen on it, although I did give it a go when I was younger. But then suddenly to see it skip a generation and to see members of my family who were really big on the piano and other musical instruments to have one of my own children then organically just playing it in exactly the same sort of style, that actually is remarkable, because you think, you know, that wasn't something that we made you do or encourage you to do and it's just happened spontaneously. So I do wonder if sometimes that we're kind of set on a particular path, and that ultimately in life, and we'll talk in a minute about future journey points, but I do wonder if we're sort of almost set up that, you know, there are certain things that I'm perhaps wary of using the word destiny, but things that perhaps we are particularly designed or particularly adept at trying to accomplish, and we kind of ultimately won't find fulfillment unless we actually do those things, whether we do them when we're young or maybe in later life.
Yeah, that's funny, because living in Spain, my son never actually saw his grandfather playing the guitar, and he never saw me either playing the guitar. And he came back from holidays, and he saw one of the students who were animating social activities, and he saw him playing the guitar. He said, "Oh, I would like to play the guitar." And it was so funny because when he started after his second year, I said, "Well, I will have a go," and then boy, I bought another a new guitar, and I started playing a bit with him in the lockdown, and I took it back again. So I've been playing just a bit of this. Not very good at it, but I find it nice.
Were there particular teachers, whether at school or university, who inspired you over the years, and and perhaps without whom you wouldn't be doing what you're doing now? I don't just mean academically so much, but actually just in terms of, because obviously you're a school teacher, but in terms of the passion, the enthusiasm, perhaps the sense that this was the right calling for you.
Obviously, it's my English teacher was when I was in Spain. In language education is not very good at the schools. So everybody have evening lessons in languages, and I started doing it when I was 10. I started learning English, and I was not very good at it either. It was really awful. I didn't want to go because you just go to school after going to school. But then I have to start attending a music school. Because music and guitar school was so awful for me. I started to like English. I have a very, very good evening teacher. And I think he was quite influential for me. It's like in England and speaking English. And afterwards, obviously, at the university, I met a very, really, really, really good lecturers, and they were also writers. So it was kind of model for me, like to be like them.
And are you in touch, or were you in touch with any of those teachers at any point, in the in more recent years?
Not really. I was in touch with my Latin teacher in school, and she sadly passed away just a month before the book was.
Oh no.
And I was so sad because I would have liked to go to Roman mythology, but it was just one month before.
Oh no, I'm sorry to hear that, because that's what I was thinking of. Because the idea that you can go back to those teachers who inspired you and say, it's a circuitous route. It may not be a direct, you, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have written this. Of course, along the way, there are all sorts of other, you put your own signature on what you're working on. But to actually go back to those teachers and say, in part, at any rate, I wrote this because of your great
Yes,
teaching all those
definitely.
decades ago, and what and how proud they must be.
Yeah, probably. But it was just my Latin teacher was in contact with, and he was very, very influential to me.
Yeah. And just thinking as well about your time in Lampeter, because obviously we had that in common. Did you find that a very different sort of experience? Because I'm actually from Wales originally, but even Lampeter, I mean, not so much the university teaching, but living in a Welsh part of Wales, but being Welsh but not speaking Welsh, was a curious dynamic. But I'm guessing that in some ways, and not least because there was always a very good, range of linguists and students from all around the world who'd descend on Lampeter. But did you find in your time in Lampeter, was there anything about the teaching you had there that had an influence on what you've gone on to do?
Well, mainly I think it was the people I met there. People from many different countries, and I was very, very, very interesting. People from Finland, from Sweden, from Germany, from France, from Italy. Sadly, it was not so many British students I got in touch so much with. Some of them, Martin Bloomfield and Damon Trion, who was my wedding witness. Apart from them, well, I didn't get so well on with other students, mainly because some of them they were in the third year, and they already met them each other. It was kind of difficult to enter some group of students who are very close together, and I found it a bit difficult to, apart from four or five people I really got on well with.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because there was something about I think you're right that people are sort of going to be in their particular year clusters. But I was just thinking, because I work in Canterbury at the University of Kent, and we've got a lot of students who are obviously students from all over the place, but we have a lot of students who tend to be local-ish or from the southeast of England or London. And in that sense, that's quite familiar, that the students in the classroom, if you like, are not all that different from the people outside the university. But when I was in Lampeter, I was in West Wales, where the local people spoke Welsh, and I should have spoken better Welsh than I did. But the students I knew were, as you say, students from all over the place. And it felt as though the world was coming to Lampeter. And even though when I was at school, people would sometimes say, why would you go all the way there? It's very remote and very rural and very cut off. But if anything, I felt that I had a more cosmopolitan experience there than I probably would have done at, for example, a city university.
Yeah, I think so. It is. Lampeter was amazing. I have friends who were making the Erasmus program the same year as me. Have friends staying in Swansea and in Cardiff. Especially remember the friend who comes from Cardiff said, but come on, this was supposed to be less interesting than Cardiff. Cardiff was supposed to be the big city. But he came for a weekend and he said, and the big experience is here. Because I have met more interesting and different people in just one weekend than in Cardiff the whole year. I think it was quite surprising for people didn't know what was going on there, which is...
And I think that's one of the lovely surprises in this, because I went to I'm from Cardiff, but so many of my friends, I mean, not just randomly, it almost felt as though more often than not, those who stayed in Cardiff, and many did, and maybe they had good reason, for example, it may have been like a parent was ill or they wanted to be close to their family, all very, legitimate reasons. But I'm the one who, in going into West Wales, was taking more of a risk, taking more of an adventure than they did, because they still lived at home. Now, in many cases, as I say, they may have had absolutely good reasons, financial or work or to be close to family reasons for doing it. But I'd see them in the holidays and I'd say, what's it like being a student in Cardiff, and they'd say, oh, well, I've only been out once or twice because I just come home, and it was just like school. It was like the school environment all over again. And I'm the one who felt that I was having this amazing adventure. So that actually, when my undergraduate days ended, obviously there's a whole range of reasons why one stays on, not least to get advance one's career. But I did 3 degrees in Lampeter, and I kind of feel that I had more of an experience, I think, than some of the people who, on paper at any rate, seem to be living the city life.
Yeah, for me, it was not very, very, very surprised because I had a friend who has been the year before. So it's kind of, and I coming from a very, very small village. For me, it was not so difficult to be cut off in the middle of nowhere. As people say, Lampeter is in the middle of nowhere. No. Yeah. Lampeter is in the middle of Lampeter. It's enough.
And do you have any, have you ever, for example, like kept a diary, or do you have any records of not just Lampeter, but just generally in your past? Do you have a record of all the things that you did when you were younger?
Oh, no, definitely not. And I wouldn't never do that. Yeah. Because when I write, I'd like to imagine things. But I like and I love reading other people's diaries. And I find it fascinating to go into the past, but I wouldn't be able to write a diary. But the thing that I like a lot is like nowadays you have these archives and online archives, and you can go the Spanish television archives are very good because they are free, and basically you have nearly everything, and you can watch the news of May 1982, and you can actually watch and sometimes I've done it, and I said, I remember actually when I saw that exactly, I can remember very, very clearly what it was there. And sometimes you have surprise, and I said to Belin, I nearly have a very, very good story for Chris. Well, I think it's a good story, but it nearly was a very, very good one. It was about when the day I decided I wanted to be a writer. And I was 12. I remember it very clearly. And it was I was watching on the television an interview with Mario Vargas Llosa, with a Peruvian Nobel Prize. And I was so fascinated by the way he was speaking. He was not, I haven't even read nothing from him because I was too young. But I thought, oh my God, the way he uses the language and the way he uses about spoke about imagination and telling stories. I was completely fascinated by him. And at the end of this program, he said, someone of 12 years old, of my age, should read The Three Musketeers. And I was very impressed. I don't know, I read Three Musketeers after that. And 20 years afterwards, I managed to meet him in person in a book dedicate. And because it was in France, I didn't want to buy one of his books translated into French. So I went to the library, to the bookshop, and I bought The Three Musketeers. And then I asked him, I think he didn't understand why I was wanted him to sign The Three Musketeers. And I told him, when I was 12, he said a kid of 12 years old should read this book. And then he dedicated us the book he would have liked to wrote. When I was preparing years ago, one of my lessons, and because now you have in YouTube, you have the interview. And I went to see the interview. Oh my God, he never saw that. I saw the interview in YouTube. I said it was a false memory. He never said that. And I thought it was a false memory. And I was speaking with him with a false memory. But last week, I decided to watch it again. And then I saw the full program. And he didn't see it in the interview that was cut off in YouTube. And he did it afterwards. And someone, it was Franco's granddaughter, said, well, I've got a 12-year-old boy. What should he read? But I said, well, I nearly have a very, very good story about false memories. Actually, it was not false. But it's a good story.
That's a really good story because what it highlights is that, you know, sometimes memories can be composite or it's sort of like pretty right. But you know, if you do the same thing every day or if you have particular routines sometimes, well, you're not always going to be able to distinguish one particular event from another. I mean, obviously what you've described is like a one-off, but it's interesting that it was not. So you remembered it, but you wouldn't have known at the time what was necessarily being filmed or recorded and then which bits you'd be watching all those decades on. So the fact that the bit that you remembered was from like the Q&A or you know, from a discussion afterwards means actually it's a pretty stable and good memory, because obviously you were watching it, say, from an audience point of view, but watching it on the TV, you're watching it in a completely different lens because the camera angles are going to be different and you're going to see the person in a different way up close and personal. Maybe the quality is not going to be great because of, you know, it was obviously recorded in the 80s or whatever. And so in a way, you're watching a distorted version of something that you were at, but told from a different vantage point and with somebody else directing the show or, you know, holding the camera. So actually, that's quite a resilient memory that you were actually, sounds like you were pretty spot on.
Yeah, so I was quite relieved. I was not making a fool of myself by speaking with a Nobel Prize literature.
Well, you enjoy writing about the imagination, so actually you can. But I do think there's something in that because with there's another angle as well, which is why I keep a diary, which is that, well, it's not the only reason by any means, but it's inadvertently been a plus. If somebody ever says, "Oh, I never said that," or "I never went there," or "That never happened," and you can say, "Well." On this day, it was written, you know, I suppose somebody could say that you made up the entry, although I suppose you'd have to then, you know, go through it and say, well, if all the other bits corroborate, then, you know, why would you have made this one up 30 or 40 years ago? But it is interesting that sometimes I certainly anyway have a need sometimes almost to corroborate my memory so that I feel that I'm not, you know, losing my mind. I suppose in my life, various times I feel I have been losing my mind. So the diary is a good corrective against that. Just thinking, Jose, as we start to wrap up, Would you say, as you look back on your life and career, that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Definitely, definitely. Because I don't want to remember the not good. So definitely, most of my memories are good. I think also because I'm lucky. I have had a lucky life. So yes, even if sometimes life is difficult, life is sad, but on the whole, I'm quite lucky, so I cannot have bad memories.
No, and I was just thinking, actually, because you and we touched on this earlier when we were mentioning lockdown, but I suppose you can be, whether nostalgic is the right word, I don't know, but certainly you can use negative experiences for positive purposes. You did that because you wrote your novel during lockdown. You know, it was a negative experience. No one's going to say lockdown was a good thing to happen. Well, it was good in the sense that it meant that the virus was controlled, but, you know, but obviously it meant that people are all, you know, in confinement. But actually, it sounds as though you're somebody who can draw on some of those maybe, you know, less than creative or injurious things and actually find something good to, you know, to come out of them.
Well, yeah, to be honest, when I was in the lockdown, I was one of the reasons why I wrote it. In 10 years, what am I going to remember from the lockdown? And I want to choose what I'm going to remember from the lockdown. And it is me writing. So that's what's one of the reasons I did.
It's always interesting, isn't it? Because I know a lot of people started writing diaries in lockdown, and similar to you, you know, you started, and lots of cases of people like celebrities writing autobiographies and all that sort of thing, you know, and they all did it during lockdown. But I always think that's interesting, but what about the things you were doing or not doing in previous years before lockdown? In other words, what really changed? It's, as somebody like me who's kept a diary, I can look at what I was doing 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 30 years even before lockdown. So I've got a point of comparison. If you start doing everything in lockdown itself, you don't get a very full picture sort of sense of what's different in your life. And for anybody reading that in the future, if let's say it was disseminated or published, people will only get a partial glimpse into your life over over a particularly limited period.
Yeah, well, the thing is that I also wrote on other moments of my life, so it's not I didn't start doing it. The difference is that now it's published because it's independently published, and so
fantastic.
What I like to do is I wrote where I write. So some of the stories are written in Spain. Some others are written in France. Mm. Or started written in.
It sounds to me like you said you don't keep a diary, but actually, in a funny way, that is your diary. It sounds like, because that's charting your life.
Exactly.
So it's just a different. It's just a different type of writing. You know. Yeah. Do you think fulfilled the dreams you had maybe when you were young? It sounds. I mean, I know we touched on this earlier, but I suppose there's always that question about what you might have done, or when you were younger, did you have any particular ambitions or dreams, or did you imagine doing something different, maybe career-wise, or, you know, would you have imagined that you'd be living and doing the things that you're doing now from the point of view, say, of your teenage self?
Well, it depends, because my teenage, when I was 13, I wanted to be a basketball player. It was obviously stopped growing up, so I was quite bad for that. And then when I was 15, I wanted to be a rock singer. That was not very good, though. And that was always this idea that I wanted to write. So, yeah, I think I have done most of the thing I wanted to do. And there was one thing I wanted to do. I wanted to write poems that I did. I wanted to write plays, and I did it. And I wanted to write songs. And last year, I managed to write my first song. So
it sounds wonderfully complete. you're the journey, and you're still on a journey in the sense that, you know, you've still got ambitions. You've written one novel. I'm going to guess that, you know, who knows what's going
to
happen
to
next.
To be honest, it would be great to be paid for.
You see, and now that's the thing, isn't it? Because it's the difference between people, you know, I suppose it's the difference between a job and a vocation, or, you know, the idea that sometimes, you know, you as a teacher, that's your job, but the writing might be more of a vocation. But to be paid for a vocation, yeah, I guess that would be better. I think so. I think so. But then again, I don't know, because sometimes it's always maybe a bit more risky when those fantasies or the dreams or the more creative things suddenly become, you know, come into the ascendance, and then you realise that everything pivots around that rather than have that as the comfort to go to.
And because I'm not paid, I'm freer.
Yeah.
So don't have to
sell out.
Yeah. And also, my father was the same. He's a composer, and he's been playing and writing music the whole of his life. He was a teacher, and then he worked on school administrations. But he's always been a composer and a musician. Yeah. So and he never been paid for that. He even gave lessons for free. He's 84, and he still does it, just because he likes music and he likes to transmit to pass over his knowledge and his passion for music. I guess it's some same pattern.
Yeah, it's and if not you, your son or your daughter, you know, you can see that in different ways. It's all going to sort of reach its inevitable, you know, conclusion. I got one more question for you, Jose. Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Definitely looking forward. And that's, I think, I'm nostalgic because the things that I feels good, I think these are the roots for the future, the things that I like. I even have a present time nostalgia, especially a subject, you know, you are very interested in, it's a Christmas. But I'm every year I'm nostalgic about, because I know that this year Christmas will be next year nostalgia. I think definitely looking forward.
I think that's a perfect answer, and you've, you know, it's a good job you're not interviewing me, or we'd be going on for another hour because you've ended at just, you know, the point where I would start. Absolutely, Christmas and nostalgia, and that's an absolutely sort of integral part of my own set of interests. But Jose, it has been so wonderful and great to catch up with you.
Thank you very much.